Clare Valley.
Clare Valley.
Clare Valley.
Clare Valley.
Clare Valley Podcast.
Clare Valley,
Clare
Podcast.
Valley Podcast.
Clare Valley Podcast.
Clare Valley Podcast. You're listening.
Clare Valley Podcast.
Clare Valley Podcast.
Welcome to the Clare Valley Podcast, Episode 7, keeping you informed on the latest council news, upcoming projects and events from the Clare and Gilbert Valleys Council. I'm your host, Annabelle Homer. Coming up, a behind-the-scenes story of the Clare Oval redevelopment. Did you know this project has been on the cards since 2014? Finally, demolition has begun and a brand spanking new multi-million dollar sporting complex will be complete by June next year.
Some of the highlights are obviously the four unisex change rooms, which will make it a lot more attractive to get larger sporting events here, for starters. Female sporting events like female footy, female cricket, give the netballers somewhere to shower and get dressed as well. We're also upgrading the lighting of the oval. So that will enable us to do night sports, essentially. Like the lights that we've got here now are, you know, not sufficient for any sort of form of competitive sport. You know, we've done a full lighting design and, yeah, so the ability to be able to host a night event here, whether it be football or anything really, under lights, that's a huge advantage to the community in general.
Also, if you were hoping for a water park to be built in the Clare Valley by this summer, you may be waiting for a while now as there's been a bit of controversy surrounding the new lease of the caravan park. And if you are an irrigator or a broadacre farmer or intensive livestock producer and struggling to access enough water to run your operation, there are moves to access another water option to supply water users in the Clare Valley. But first, it's been a busy and controversial month for the Clare and Gilbert Valleys Council. Some members of the community have raised concerns over the new lease of the Clare Caravan Park. This new lease was signed in January this year to Discovery Parks. As part of this lease, Discovery Parks also wanted to expand the caravan park to include the adjacent Catford Gardens to build a water park. As Catford Gardens is community-owned land, the details of this expansion needed to go out for public consultation. This meant the details of the entire new lease was available for the public to see, which then led to concerns about the new lease in general, especially Section 10.9. CEO of the Clare and Gilbert Valleys Council, Dr. Helen McDonald, is here to fill you in on all the details.
I suppose in terms of the process, Council had approved the lease to be signed in December, and that was done in January and was with the Small Business Commissioner, because that has to go through because the existing lease has to be annulled, shall we say. And then in January, it was also discovered that there was a community land management plan over Catford Park, which was to be included in the new lease area for the caravan park. So essentially, okay, the caravan park was going to have a bigger footprint.
So this was after the initial lease was signed in January. You found out that...
Indeed. Okay. That's right. So we found out that, we should have known that, but we didn't, and it was discovered afterwards. So upon discovering that, I informed council and that we would need to go out to community consultation, and also had the lawyers pull the deed of variation from the Small Business Commissioner so that process of the lease being finalised would be ceased, obviously let Discovery know what was happening, and then we went out to community consultation, which the consultation was about the inclusion of the additional area of land. And we did that. The period was extended beyond the required term of consultation that we have. And basically we ended up with around 30 submissions, and a majority of those were actually in favour of the caravan park being the area being expanded and the lease being given to Discovery. Because as part of what we're required to do, we have to make the lease public as part of the consultation. And in that process, obviously, there was at least one person that looked through that lease and found there were some things that they didn't like.
In particular?
The section, which is 10.9. I don't know if you want me to actually say what's in it. It's very complex.
Or we'll just, if you can summarise what.
Well, essentially, it's 10.9 is about responsibility for the buildings. And one of the things that is in there, that if the lease finishes, or towards the end of the lease, and there is no, and council doesn't want to have a caravan park there anymore, then Discovery are required to remove all of their buildings and potentially everything else that's there. So all the built infrastructure would need to be removed because it's very expensive to demolish buildings and remove infrastructure. And so if that's what council at that time is wish was, now they might want to keep a caravan park, therefore there would be nothing. But it also, the lease also includes some discussion about, and all of this is about negotiation. So Clare, Gilbert Valley's council and Discovery have to negotiate what solution they want. But basically, it has these requirements of things that have to be considered. And it's also part of that 10.9 clause is also a section about if Discovery have to make a major investment into some built infrastructure not long from prior to the end of the lease, there would have to be a negotiation with council because you can't ask somebody to invest in a building 5 years out from the end of the lease and they still then have to pay rent on that property. So it's basically, it's a negotiated outcome that has to be required between the two parties in terms of what goes ahead because, you know, nobody quite knows, you know, what the future will look like, but there's enough in there to cover both parties. Essentially, what happened was people looked at the lease. I have to say they did not understand it, but were scared by it. And so made submissions on that part. Now, council was not consulting about the content of the lease. Council has already had significant consultation with its commercial legal advisor about the content of the lease and can have more if they require it. So that's been one of the things that's concerned some people about the caravan park.
Do you think also the length of the lease is a concern for people? 21 years plus 21 years of renewal?
I think it has been a bit of a concern for some people, but you can't expect anybody to invest millions of dollars to improve an asset on the basis of a short lease. I mean, Discovery already have a 21-year lease. What is allowed now under the legislation is that they can have 21 plus 21, and that's not an automatic rollover. The council that's in place will have to make that decision towards the end of the first 21 years. So if they don't think that Discovery is a good tenant, they can say, no, we don't want you to have the lease anymore, and they can refuse to roll it over. It's just they have the first right, shall we say, to have the lease renewed for another 21 years. You know, and the purpose is if you're going to invest lots of money, you want to have some security that the investment you're making is going to serve for the long term. It's basically a return on investment, and if they don't have a decent term, they're not going to invest.
I understand that the lease wasn't actually due to expire for another 7 years. Why was there negotiations being done with Discovery? Why didn't council go out to an open market and, say, offer this to a range of different businesses rather than just talk to Discovery?
Discovery have the right to renew, so they have the first right to basically take up a new lease, and they wanted to finish the current lease much earlier so that they could make an investment. Now, if you want that investment, you either work with Discovery to make it now or you wait until the end of the lease and then go out then. Council decided, no, it was happy to engage with Discovery because they recognised that the investment that Discovery would make would be unlikely to be made by anybody else, but it would bring, you know, huge opportunities for the Clare and Gilbert Valleys Council and community, I should say, if that investment was made sooner rather than later.
Were you afraid that if you didn't go into negotiations with Discovery that they might have left the region?
Well, I suppose that's possible. I don't think that was... I mean, I can't say what was in the councillor's mind, but it certainly wasn't something that was an issue in terms of my mind in thinking about it. It was more about it's an opportunity and you either take advantage of the opportunity or you don't.
Following the public consultation, and you've told us the results of that public consultation, where is this issue sitting right now? What's the next step?
Following consultation, it went to council. Council didn't really take any notice of any of the consultation. Well, they may take a notice of it, but they did not make any decision in relation to that consultation process. there seems to be a lot of anxiety about Section 10.9 of the lease agreement. However, they did not make a decision about looking at that and making sure they understood that. What they have decided was for there to be a statutory review and process review. So have we gone through all the necessary steps that we needed to go through so that there is a legally binding lease in place?
But you consulted with lawyers before this?
Yes.
So you, now you're going to a different set of lawyers and doing the same thing?
Indeed.
And how long is this going to take?
Not entirely sure, but if it can be done before the next council meeting would be great, but I can't guarantee that that will be the case because the lawyer hasn't yet to look at the information that they need to work through.
So what is this going to achieve, having this statutory review?
Well, I suspect, one, it'll just delay the process, so that delays the decision. Usually when you do a statutory review, it's because you have a lot of anxieties that the process is not correct. And so that's essentially what it does. But you don't normally do that unless you've got deep suspicions that you haven't gone through the right process.
Helen, you've been in this game for a very long time with councils and the process. Are you confident that everything has been ticked, due process has been carried through?
Yes, I'm very confident that due process has gone through. You know, have I done everything perfectly? Absolutely not. Hindsight's a wonderful thing and you can always think of things that you could have done better or you could have said better. But, you know, I don't think, I'm, you know, certain that council is not legally exposed in any way. We could have been legally exposed if I had decided, oh no, I'm just going to ignore the fact that we've got a community land management plan and not go out to consultation.
And you wouldn't have done that anyway.
No, I wouldn't have because I think that's far too risky. I could have, but no. Rather, I thought, look, you know, swallow the pride and just go and tell council this should have been done. It hasn't. We've got to do it, which is what we did.
So what's Discovery Park saying all about this? Are they going to go ahead with this new lease once the statutory review has been complete?
Well, obviously I can't speak for Discovery, but in terms of the discussions I've had, because obviously as a courtesy I contacted them after the council meeting, even though they were actually listening in, and let them know where things were going and what I proposed to do. But, you know, like council, like any business, they're in the process of finalising their budget for the next year. And so I suspect, I don't know this for sure, but any development for the Clare Caravan Park will not take place in the next 12 to 18 months.
So no water park?
No, I mean, even if they get a lease in the next few months, I suspect, I mean, they've got a lot of things happening. They're, you know, expanding their footprint, you know, across the nation. They've got plenty of places to invest in, and I suspect that they have already made a decision about alternative places to spend that money, but that's really something they have to speak about.
This must be disappointing for Discovery because this is not a new thing for them. They've been in negotiations with council for 4 years about building on to the caravan park, especially building a water park of some nature.
Yes, they have, and I'm sure it is disappointing because the whole purpose of the discussions that started back in 2018 with Discovery, they first raised it, but we didn't really have any real discussions with the council until 2019 when the new council was on board. But basically their whole purpose is to be able to feel the decline in patronage that happens during the summer months, because obviously when you have sort of mid-30s to 40-degree days, most people from the Clare and Gilbert Valleys, they go to the coast or they go to the river, and so do people from Adelaide. So we don't get the visitation. And so having something like a water park would increase the attractiveness so that we've got more people coming to the Clare Valley. So that's their purpose of wanting to have a new lease that gave them longevity so that they could invest those millions and millions of dollars. And council, I think, very early saw that that would have a knock-on benefit to the broader community and to the Clare Main Street. In fact, you know, if you've got people coming here during summer, then there's good reasons that people can keep the shop doors open and it becomes an interesting place.
Moving on to the rates review, we discussed this quite heavily in the last podcast last month. And what has been the outcome to the rates review?
Well, council has just put it on ice, shall we say, for a couple of months. As we indicated in our report, it was pretty clear that all councillors weren't yet ready to make a decision. They need to have a better understanding. And apart from that, we're going in with the budget and business plan and trying to go out to consultation with those two things, I think could be quite confusing for the community. So, because essentially what a rate review is a policy change. It's looking to make policy changes rather than try and rush that through and confusing everybody. That's been held off until we've got the business and annual business plan and the budget through.
So next financial year.
Yeah, essentially, that's right.
Also, just an aside, if you're wanting to see if there'll be a change in rates this coming financial year, the draft budget is due out for public consultation in mid-May. Helen, let's talk about the Hale River feedlot expansion. What's council's position on this?
Well, council obviously houses, shall we say, the planning staff that get to process applications, deal with inquiries or questions around planning permission. So at this point in time, I think there's been lots of sort of bits of communication between primarily those people that are neighbours to Hale River and their concerns about the feedlot. And they essentially been lobbying council to try and stand against the feedlot. Now, that's not council's role. Council is not involved in planning decisions as
What's
such.
The, why are landholders lobbying the council to go against the feedlot? Well, what are their motives?
Well, there's a couple of things. One, you know, raising concerns about the impact that the feedlot will have on water, their tourism businesses, etc. You know, it's a range of things. So that's one thing, which are not council concerns. They're issues that need to be dealt with by the EPA when permitting something like a feedlot. They go and through and analyse those potential impacts to work out whether or not a permit should be granted. Council's role is in issuing the planning permission to build the infrastructure. That's council's role, and having intensive agriculture like a feedlot is, you know, what you would call a deemed activity in a primary production zone. So the Hale River property is in the middle of a primary production zone and surrounded by primary production. So theoretically, it should be able to operate, assuming that the impacts in terms of odour, noise, impact on water, etc., the things that the EPA looked at, that the EPA is comfortable that there are not going to be issues. So that's, I suppose, the division of labour between council and the planning law and the EPA and the EPA legislation.
So even though Hale River is expanding, that doesn't mean it needs a new development application at this point. It can expand on the current development application.
Theoretically, yes, it could if it had been operating as a feedlot since it was built initially back in the early 90s. But if it has not been used as a feedlot for a period, then potentially the planning permission may be seen to have lapsed. It's a really kind of unclear part of the Planning Act or Development Act. It's not actually spelt out what would trigger something to be lapsed or what the period of time that if you weren't using. It has to be proved that it's not only not been operating as a feedlot, but also being used as something else. So that becomes a change of use in terms of the planning permission. So then that is probably a stronger trigger for planning permission for a feedlot to be deemed to have lapsed.
So it's been operating as a transfer station for many years, not a feedlot. So is that deemed...
If that can be proved, and so all of this is about there being proof, because there's lots of assertions being put about, so it has to be actually provable in a court of law that it's not operated as a feedlot for a period of time. But a transfer station is different from a feedlot. So if it can be proved that it's been operating as a transfer station for a number of years, then that would be potentially enough to say that the planning permission for the feedlot had lapsed.
Right. Okay. So where
is the process at the moment? Because we understand that the EPA has been taking submissions and visiting landholders' properties over the last month or so. So where is the process up to now with that position in mind with council, knowing that legal teams are getting involved, you're consulting with your legal teams? What's the next step?
Well, essentially council, or it's not really, it's not council, it's a planning department.
Within council?
Yeah, within council, have been reacting to requests and submissions from the community or their community members' legal advisors. So at this point in time, we're at the point of saying, well, you have asserted that the operation of the feedlot has lapsed, so you need to provide evidence. So my understanding is that they're collecting evidence to prove that it's lapsed. And on the other hand, we've also got to approach Hale River and ask them the same question in terms of, or a similar question, in terms of now what evidence do you have to show that you've been operating it as a feedlot for the period that you've owned the property. So at the moment, we're in the process of collecting evidence so that then the planning department can make a decision about whether it's lapsed or not. And then there could be potentially legal appeal against each of those decisions, depending on which way it went. But if we go through the theoretical steps, so let's say that planning permission was deemed to have lapsed. Hale River then can apply for new planning permission, and that would then be processed by our planning staff. The application would go through our regional assessment panel. Neighbours would have an opportunity to make submissions about that, which would be heard by the assessment panel. The assessment panel would also very quickly turn to the EPA and say, EPA, what's your advice about whether or not a feedlot should be here and whether or not it should be expanded? Because I think that's where it all started, was Hale River wanted to expand the size of the feedlot. It would be determined essentially at the end of the day by the advice that comes back from the EPA.
The current EPA investigation has been put on ice until the planning department within council makes a decision as to whether this feedlot operation has lapsed. If it has lapsed, the whole process of developing a new development application starts, and which then the EPA will be consulted again, and then a decision will be made.
That's right.
Essentially what's going to happen.
Yeah.
How long does that process take?
Once an application is put in, for example, for a new planning permission, it goes fairly quickly. There's set times in which things, the EPA is the same. So there are set periods at which you're supposed to deal with these things. Yeah, I could imagine that it would probably take three months minimum to get through.
So is this going to cost ratepayers money when you bring legal teams into the whole process?
Well, every time we have to consult lawyers about technical issues, which is particularly around has planning permission lapsed, because that's just not spelled out clearly. In terms of legal costs, the biggest risk for council in terms of, and ratepayers obviously, is if it ends up in court, because once you end up in court, the costs for lawyers, etc., it gets very expensive. So we hope it doesn't go there. But
what does history show?
Prior to the change of the planning legislation, so that it's now called the Planning Code, and the way in which these development processes were undertaken, feedlots usually always end up at the highest level, the EIRD court, because people always seem to challenge whether they should go ahead. That's probably not quite as expensive as going to the court, but still it requires significant investments, particularly by the applicant, in terms of having various studies, etc., done.
We'll revisit this topic in the next podcast to see where things are at with the Hale River feedlot expansion.
We can certainly see where it's got to at that point. Yeah, certainly.
One of the stories that we're focusing on the Clare Valley podcast this month is the Clare Valley Water Project. There's a push for as many water users to be part of this project to try and encourage another option of water delivery to the Clare Valley. Councils are being urged to submit to this process. Is the Clare and Gilbert Valleys Council interested in going down this track?
We haven't formally, or it hasn't formally been discussed with the elected members, but certainly I think there's no reason that council shouldn't put its hand up to say, yep, look, we'd be interested. Got to know what the, you know, the potential cost might be to council, but I think just generally having an alternative water source for the community is ideal in terms of the long-term future with climate change, having alternative water sources for things like keeping parks and sporting fields green, even, dare I suggest, filling up Lake Inchiquin, which has for a number of years looked very sad because it's not full of water. So.
Does council do that? Do you actually fill up the lake?
No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. But that would be, that's like, I have no idea what the cost would be and what the maintenance cost would be. But, you know, that I know it that the community, and certainly some members of the community, think that council should do that. And maybe that if we had an alternative water source, that it might be something we'd look at. I don't know. Yeah.
CEO of the Clare and Gilbert Valleys Council, Dr. Helen McDonald.
Clare Valley Podcast.
Clare Valley Podcast.
You're listening.
Clare Valley Podcast.
Clare Valley Podcast.
As mentioned earlier, there are moves to investigate a long-term water security solution for the Clare Valley. A preliminary business case is being prepared by KBR, a company that delivers solutions to governments, to try and gauge the demand for an alternative water option that is sustainable, flexible and affordable for water users, be it treated water from the River Murray, raw water or recycled water. Now, this project is possible through an $800,000 Commonwealth grant, which was secured through the National Water Infrastructure Grid Fund by the Clare Valley Wine and Grape Association. Water users across the valley are being asked to submit their expressions of interest to the Clare Valley Water Project so consultants can gauge the demand for another water option. This is not for households, more for irrigators, broadacre farmers and intensive livestock producers. According to the Clare Valley Wine and Grape Association, the current SA Water's Clare Valley Water Supply Scheme isn't meeting the needs of all users. Some can't access the network and others can't get enough water. I caught up with Leasingham grape grower Grant Carr, who's also a board member of the Clare Valley Wine and Grape Association, and the association's executive officer Anna Baum, to find out why this project is so important for the valley and why it's integral that all appropriate water users submit to the process. The more demand there is for another water option, the more likely it will be investigated further. But first, let's get a picture of what the current water situation is like for a grape grower in the Clare Valley. Here's Grant Carr.
So I guess as a grower, I can comment on where our water comes from. You know, at the moment we have two options on our property. We've got the bore that is an old bore that's been there for a while. You know, when we first bought the property, we could use the water, but over the years it's become less dependable. And so at the point where in the last couple of summers, we really haven't had much water from the bore at all. So therefore, we were able to use our second water source, which is SA Water Mains, so one of the products that SA Water provides. And I guess that would be a similar situation for growers across the valley. Typically, you've got access to surface water, groundwater, and augmented water, if you like, from an SA Water pipeline.
Why do you feel that there's a shortfall with that system at the moment?
So speaking to our members, we understand that some members are not on the distribution network for the SA Water Mains. And we also know that in general across the valley, bores are less reliable than they were. Anecdotally, they are saltier than they were, although not necessarily in all cases. So we know from our member, and also I guess members who do have access to the SA Water Mains are limited in their flow rate just because of the capacity of the pipeline. And so therefore it's difficult for those irrigators to get as much water as they need onto the grapes.
Do you think the wine industry, even the grape growing industry in the Clare Valley, would expand quite substantially if they had more access to water?
I think the early indications from surveys that we have conducted would suggest that there is a reasonable amount of growth in the valley. There is also an opportunity to put down more water on existing acreage. And I guess also it has to be said that the SA Water product, certainly the product that I use, is time of day, and therefore you can only irrigate during a certain time of day, during a certain time of year. So it doesn't allow you the flexibility to, say, irrigate during winter, you know, considering that the earth can be a storage means as well. So, yeah, so I guess flexibility is a big thing. So accessibility for some members is not there. the actual flexibility to use the water whenever you want to is not necessarily there. And then the ability to expand your plantings, again, is very dependent on whether or not you can secure water.
So we're at a point where, I suppose, in the region, SA Water's having a bit of look at, you know, is it time, do we have to review the current network? And it's also a perfect time for us to do some further investigations. So I said to you that this stemmed out of some earlier work, which was funded by PIRZA and the Landscape Board, the local Landscape Board, which looked at a very high level look at, you know, what could be some other options to help secure our water supply. It recommended that we did some further work. So that's basically what we've done, and we've been able to, this current project, which is called the Clare Valley Water Project, we've been able to attract some federal government funding. And this is an investigation which, if there's some positive recommendations out of it, will go on to further and more detailed investigations and possibly something being constructed. So it's a pretty exciting time and a really important point in the journey.
To get some perspective, how much water is already used through the current scheme in the Clare Valley? And is it quite expensive water compared to other grape-growing areas?
We use about all up with the SA Water potable network and groundwater resources, I think I'd probably say we use between 4 and 5 gigalitres of water in this region.
So how does that compare to the Barossa Valley?
We're a smaller region. We use a lot less water. I think they might use 11 or 12 gigalitres, but they're looking at using a lot more, but I'm not sure about that. But when you talk about the price of water, Clare Valley is certainly known for having quite high priced water in general. I think, you know, the consultants were saying in the recent meeting that the average price of water in the Clare Valley is probably double that of the Barossa. The reason why it's so expensive is because it's potable water. So in 2004, we had the Clare Valley Water Supply Scheme was built in the region, and that was a network of potable water to feed all the little towns between Auburn and Clare. And part of the construction of that scheme was that grape growers would contribute to a capital contribution towards that scheme to help to get it up and running. It's been an absolute godsend for the wine industry. But unfortunately, it is an expensive source of water because it's potable and because it's drinkable. So just as it has happened, it's increased in price over the last, you know, 15 years quite dramatically.
Grant, do you want to come in at this point? From a grape grower's perspective, how much are you paying for water at the moment?
Yeah, so as Anna said, the SA Water Scheme has been, you know, very important to growers. Without it, you're reliant solely on groundwater and surface water. For us, we expanded our vineyard last year, and would not have been able to do that if we didn't have the stability and, you know, knowing that we had security of the SA Water scheme. You know, that said, we use what's called the time of day product, TOD product, which means that the product can only be used between 8 p.m. at night and 6 a.m. in the morning. For that, it costs, there's a few different steps in the process outside of the licenses and permits that you must have through Department of Environment and Water and the Landscape Board. There are upfront costs, which are called transportation costs, and that is currently $1,800 per megalitre. So that is basically the money that you're paying SA Water to transport River Murray water on your behalf from a point to your vineyard. On top of that, you also need to own a Murray River allocation. And so that's either temporarily for a season or it's on a permanent basis. At the moment, the permanent water is selling for upwards of $7,000 per megalitre. And in the season just past, I paid, including fees and commissions and brokerage, etc., I think we paid roughly $200 per megalitre. So in the season just past, we were paying approximately $2,000 per megalitre of water used. There is a rule of thumb around 1 meg per hectare. Damn. Yeah, and that's, to be precise, it's one meg per hectare owned, not necessarily per hectare planted. So in our case, we have 6 hectares of land, but only 4 hectares planted. So we can use up to 6 hectares or 6 megalitres of water.
What was your annual water bill?
the annual water bill would have equated to somewhere between $7,000 and $8,000.
Yeah, and you're a pretty small player.
We're a very small, very small player. We had 4 hectares, and we had some, you know, some weather issues this year that basically, you know, grossly reduced our crop. So for me individually, water is the single biggest cost. And in a year like this year, then, you know, there's no real hope of making any money off the vineyard.
So what a grape grower is saying, because water prices can fluctuate so much, are grape prices going up in line with water prices? I mean, are they making any money?
I think, you know, it's right what the consultants say, that probably water is twice the price of water in the Barossa, and grape prices are half of that, so the margins are a lot tighter.
Just on the price of water being twice the Barossa, I think it's important that we do, just to be clear, they are different water products. The water product that's currently available to the Clare Valley, as Anna said earlier, is a potable drinking water solution. The water that's used for the Bill scheme, the Barossa Infrastructure Limited scheme in the Barossa, is raw Murray water, so it has not been treated. So in the interest of fairness, it's important to point out, but that's the only water solution that we have in the valley. Mm. And so therefore, you know, it's right that we say it's twice as expensive, because it is.
So what other water products are there?
So there's 3 products on the Clare Valley Water Supply Scheme, which is SA Water's potable scheme. There's the one that Grant's just talked about, which is the time of day product in the summer. So that's the summer product that can be put straight onto the vines, or it can be stored if necessary. There's the same product that you and I use. There's mm-hmm. the domestic statewide priced water product. And then there's a third product, which is a winter water product, which means that that water has to be stored in a dam. So the winter product is a low-priced product, and it's about $1,300 a megalitre. But, of course, you've got the costs of dam storage and building that. And then there's the product that Grant talked about, which is $1,800 a megalitre. Those are both products that are called transportation products. And as Grant explained, you need to buy your own water. They come up, once you've got the cost of that water, to about $1,500 a megalitre and $2,000 a megalitre. The third product is the domestic water that we talked about, and that's $2,800 a megalitre at the moment. So, you know, there's this sort of average price of somewhere between around about $2,000 a megalitre, which, as we've said, is more expensive than most other regions when you average out their water. There's also, obviously, groundwater, catchment dams, and, of course, that water isn't as expensive, but it's probably important to say that those resources are really under pressure at the moment environmentally. And another really important reason why this has become a more urgent project is because of climate change and the fact that we're really seeing so much less water going into the environment, and those native water resources are depleting at the moment.
From what I understand from the meeting that was held recently with KBR, you need as much irrigator or grower input as you can. So at the moment it's gathering information, trying to get information from growers. That's the most important thing at the moment. Are people being engaged? Are people responding to this project so far?
This whole part of the process at the moment is looking at demand. What is the demand for water in the region? It's absolutely key, because it's the basis on what the future investigative work will be done on. So we've obviously gone out to our growers and engaged them in this demand analysis, and we've also reached out broadly to the wider community. But I think that we probably haven't got the word out as well as we could, and we're certainly looking at trying to engage more people, particularly the broadacre agricultural community, plus any of the other urban water users.
Because if you don't get the demand now, if you don't get the import now, it stops the project in its tracks, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's key.
You need it.
Demand is king, I think, is what the consultants say. And yes, those forms are quite involved. So certainly what they are asking is what, you know, is the appetite or what is the demand for water at different prices. Some of those prices are incredibly high, but what they want is for people to say, no, we don't want any water at that price because it is too high. We're looking at both capital costs and annual costs. So there's questions about, you know, what is your, you know, how much water would you buy at X, Y, and Z capital prices? And then, you know, there's a range of five different annual prices, and it's really to find out where the sweet spot is and, you know, what most people are willing to pay in this region for water, and that will be the basis of the next part of their assessment.
So what are the options that have been flagged by KBR as part of this project?
Yeah, so KBR have done their initial sort of assessment and looked at what the problem is, and they're doing a long listing of options at the moment, and there's quite a few of them, and they're sort of combinations and permutations of three sort of key things. One is the current potable SA water network is one water source where some different options may arise from. The second is raw water from the River Murray, and the third is a recycled water product. So when we talk about recycled water, most people probably think about Bolivar wastewater treatment plant, and there's currently a scheme that runs off that called the NAIS, or the Northern Adelaide Irrigation Scheme. So that is the basis of the recycled water options at the moment.
How much are you willing to pay to put in more infrastructure to get another option?
Yeah,
because it all comes down to price, doesn't it?
It does, and it's a really interesting, I'll say that, an interesting time for us. We have one more payment left on the initial capital investment that we made to join the SA Water scheme. So at this point in time, talking about then making additional capital is a really difficult conversation for us, especially given the season we had, especially given the small holding that we have, low grape prices. So from my point of view, I couldn't see us being willing to spend more than the investment we have made already in the SA Water scheme. That would be our maximum, I would say. And I guess, As a family, we've spoken about it, and knowing that the, you know, any capital investment would be within the next few years, you know, that also just adds an extra level of kind of concern on top of that. But yeah, I mean, you know, currently spending $3,000 per, you know, the capital investment in the SA Water scheme up to $3,000, for us it would have to be south of that before we'd be really interested.
So one of the questions is, you know, about substitution of water. So, you know, the project wants to look at additional water, new water, and substitution of your existing water. So, for instance, if you have some groundwater that's really salty and, you know, you feel that it's not going to be able to be used in the future, you might say that I'm willing to substitute that for a new source of water at a certain price. Whereas, and it's the same sort of thing, you know, for the imported water products, some people might think that we've contributed a lot to the current scheme and I buy water that's a reasonably good price. So they might say, I'm not willing to substitute that water, but if they had to use additional statewide price water, which is a lot more expensive, they might be saying, well, actually, that's a bit expensive for me. I would substitute that for a different source. So all these things we're going to find out. But certainly, you know, people have contributed to the current scheme, and it'll be interesting to see what people decide to do.
Are willing to do.
If any future solution that's proposed is, let's just say, it's cheaper than the current solution that we have, then we would certainly be interested in looking at substituting. If it's the same or more expensive, then perhaps that just allows us to get additional water through that source. But yeah, that capital contribution is going to be the killer. It's going to be the piece that really kind of determines how attractive a solution is. You know, for example, if the solution was way cheaper than our current solution, then we may be willing to reinvest more money into a capital contribution. If it's roughly the same, then, you know, that may force us to limit what we, you know, what we put down for our demand. SA Water wouldn't have had an opportunity more recently to look at future demand, certainly not in the same timescale that this project is looking at, you know, considering 50, 60, 70 years into the future. So however the demand actually lands, it's going to be useful for all the agencies involved just to see, you know, what the region's thoughts are on water into the future.
And when we talk demand, it's not just what are you using now, and, you know, if you were, you know, it's very much looking at an operational type of demand, a likely demand, and then some real blue sky thinking. What would be the worst case scenario if we had terrible, terrible climate change and there was no groundwater, and, you know, etc. So it's really trying to gauge demand through different scenarios.
So how far afield does this scheme stretch, and geographically, who can actually apply as part of this project?
Well, I think there's no boundaries at the moment. That's the very question. Who is out there that needs water? There are certainly within the grape growing network, we have regions of the valley where the current SA water pipeline doesn't reach to. So we're obviously very keen to hear from those growers, but and also from our growers who are already have water. So we'll be able to see where the sort of hubs and the hotspots are for extra or additional demand. Or new demand for people who don't have irrigation water at the moment. But we're really hoping that people from the greater region who are interested in water, whether they be, you know, intensive livestock, piggeries, chickens, feedlots, whether it's just areas of the broader acre farming community who don't have access to pipeline water at the moment, who are concerned about their groundwater and, you know, their stock water for their stock. I think it does not matter really how far it is from Clare. We don't want to, you know, turn anyone off. And as the consultant said, if there's enough people in a location that need water, then all of a sudden it becomes practical to look at taking it a little bit further. If it's just the odd one person, that's when it becomes tricky. So spread the word, get your neighbours involved, and, yeah, absolutely.
Even councils should get involved, I understand.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, we had a discussion at that meeting the other night about urban water and, you know, different uses for water. That's not households, as we've said before, but that might be, you know, it might be sports clubs, it might be the race course, it might be, you know, it could be any other urban water usage. So very keen to capture any growth in that area as well.
Those big time growers or irrigators, would they be interested in something like this, or have they already future-proofed their operations?
Good question. look, I think everyone is interested in water security and ensuring that they have the most secure options. But they have certainly, many big growers have been very proactive in future-proofing themselves with regard to water and done the very best they can in the current situation. But I think that they too will be looking at this and looking at the future and seeing how they can continue to improve what they've got.
Is there a deadline when these submissions should be in?
Well, look, Annabelle, there is. It is meant to be the 30th of April, but obviously we're just keen to hear from anyone. So, you know, the consultants will still be taking submissions and talking to people through May. So I know this podcast doesn't go out and, you know, until the end of April. So if anyone is listening and very interested, I'd still inquire.
Anna, this is a massive project. And as you said, this is a preliminary business case that's been done at the cost of $800,000. That's huge. So imagine the next stages of the project and the overall capital cost of putting something together. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, it is extraordinary. Clearly water infrastructure costs a lot. You're talking, you know, a couple of million for a detailed business case, and I don't know what we would be talking about, you know, in the range of maybe, depending on whether it was a pipeline. If it was a pipeline, you're talking of hundreds of millions, like maybe 100 to 200 million. If it was a solution which was a smaller solution, you might be talking between 20 and 80 million. But they're the sort of figures that get bandied about.
Wow.
It is huge.
It's actually it's quite
a great
scary.
It's a great opportunity for the valley. It really is, and that's why getting everyone involved and really understanding what the need is in the valley and what the demand is, and what the demand is for the future, given climate change, given expansion, given, you know, people's thoughts for what their children might want in the future. It's very exciting.
That's Anna Baum. She's the Executive Officer of the Clare Valley Wine and Grape Association. And you also heard from Grant Carr, who's a Leasingham grape grower, also an association board member. If you would like to be part of this project and submit to the process, head to clarevalleywine.com.au, or you can call Anna directly at the Clare Valley Wine and Grape Association. One of the most exciting development projects happening in Clare right now is the Clare Oval redevelopment. You might have noticed the grandstand and nearby buildings have been demolished to make way for a multi-million dollar state-of-the-art sporting complex, which is due to be completed by June next year. It's a much anticipated project that has been on the cards for the past 8 years. The amount of work that has gone on behind the scenes is astounding, and a lot of the planning has been done by volunteers. Ryan Tregilgis is the project manager of the Clare Oval Redevelopment Committee, who has been instrumental in getting this project across the line. He explains the history of this project, what people are to expect from this new sporting complex, and what benefits it will generate for Clare and the Clare Valley as a whole. I firstly asked him, how does it feel to finally see some demolition?
Yeah, it feels good to finally see some activity down here. It's been a long road to get this far.
So you say a long road. How long has it been?
This project first was conceived in around about 2014. So it's been a good 7 or 8 years in the making to get here.
Why has it taken 7 to 8 years to get here?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. Yeah, I mean, to briefly go back over the history, the idea was first conceived by the guys who ran the bar down there. The group of volunteers who looked after that on match day approached the clubs and said, you know, we think we can do something to make this a little bit more functional, user-friendly, try and help make it easier for the volunteers and try and retain a few people at the football on a Saturday. They were just seeking out the clubs to see what their appetite was for that, and obviously there was definitely a strong appetite for it. So they formed a committee then and there, and the clubs, the Clare Sports Club is predominantly North Clare and South Clare. Yeah, they put a committee together with representatives from all the different sports clubs involved. They come up with some concept ideas, took it to council and said, basically, we want your approval to do something down here. Council basically took the project over from that point. They said they wanted to have a look at the wider use for the space down here, and they formed a larger committee with different stakeholders from a wider group of people from within the community, and they commissioned a master plan for this precinct. Which that master plan got handed down in 2018, and that included obviously the project that we're looking at now, which was stage one of that master plan, which is essentially the sports facility along the western side of the oval here, new lighting, oval lighting, and an oval resurfacing. But also there was a second and third stage in that master plan, which was some additional tennis courts and some redevelopment up that end of the precinct, and also enclosing the swimming pool out the back here. And that whole project got quantities surveyed in 2018 at around $20 million.
Wow.
It sort of stalled at that point. Yeah, so the clubs wrote to the council in late 2018, early 2019, and said, you know, what's going on with the project? And in the meantime, the council, we had a new CEO, a new mayor, a bunch of new councillors, and the response was pretty much, what project? So, so at that point, they reformed the Cork committee again.
So you started all over again.
Started again, yeah, with the sort of main goal of, let's look at stage one of that master plan, which was the sort of pain points for us. And then, yeah, we did. We went back to the council. Was our first step, go back to the council to reaffirm the original $2 million that they did commit. And when they put that master plan together, they did say, yeah, we're going to commit $2 million to this project. So the first stage was getting that commitment reaffirmed. And then, yeah, from there, we sort of set about putting the designs together and going through the process of all the approvals and seeking grant funding and all that sort of stuff.
So overall, how much is this project costing?
This will cost about $5.7 million.
Okay, so where's the money coming from?
So we've got obviously the $2 million from the Clare and Gilbert Valleys Council. We got a grant from the state government through the Office of Sport, Racing, Sport and Recreation in 2020 for $880,000. And we've got $2.54 million from the federal government through the Building Better Regions Fund. And the Clare Sports Club are stumping up the rest, which will end up being around about $350,000 in cash.
So how are you going to raise $350,000? And is there a time frame on that?
Yeah, there's, I mean, this project will be finished in June next year. So obviously we have to have that money by then. We're doing pretty well. Like we've already got a large portion of it. So yeah, but we have got some fundraising initiatives that will be, you know, we have been doing stuff over the last couple of years. It's been pretty hard. It's all every, you know, we've had major ideas that have been hampered by COVID. But yeah, we have got a major function coming up in towards the end of May. And you'll see some announcements coming out about that pretty soon. We've got some ideas, and we've got some sponsorship plans and, yeah, all those sorts of things.
Okay. Yeah. So you said you've got a large proportion of that money already. Yep. Is that just money that you've pulled together from sponsorship and previous fundraising activities?
It's mainly previous fundraising activities. Obviously, the clubs have been putting money aside for this project for, you know, 6 or 7 or 8 years now. So we've got about $110,000 already raised. So yeah, we've still got a long way to go, but we're confident we can pull together what we need to.
Well, let's talk about what's actually being built. You've said it's a large facility along the western side, but let's paint a picture.
Yeah, so if you're familiar with the Clare Oval at all, we've got sort of four standalone buildings there now. We've got an old grandstand, then to the south of that we've got a Cairns bar, and then behind it we've got one block of change rooms, and then to the south of that we've got the canteen. So all those facilities are going, and we're building one purpose-built sporting facility which is going to sort of go from the 50 metre arc to the 50 metre arc along the western side of the oval, and that'll incorporate four unisex change rooms, new umpires facilities, some coaches boxes, elevated coaches boxes, and also a new function centre with a commercial kitchen and bar facility as well. So it'll be a far more inclusive space than sort of all the little disparate buildings that we've got down here now. Yeah, so we're really looking forward to it, and the benefit that that'll bring to the volunteers, and you know, just make life a lot easier for the clubs to host a function and an event here.
The Valleys Lifestyle Centre's not been hampered at all, and neither are the tennis courts.
No, not by the end result. Obviously, they're going to experience a little bit of extra traffic, and the car parks are going to be less available during the construction phase. But we've had really good support from all the stakeholders here at the precinct.
So. Speaking of car parks, there's going to be a lot of car parks that are taken up by the new building. So are you building other car park facilities?
We are. We will lose the car parks down here along the western side of the oval. We are actually developing the area up the southeast corner of the precinct where the old Scouts Hall is there. That's the Scouts Hall's coming down. That area will all be flattened and prepared, and allocated car parking is going up there as well as part of the project.
Was there any opposition for the development to occur here at the Clare Oval? Were there other areas flagged instead?
In my time, like when I got involved in the committee, which was only when we reformed it in 2019, was when I got involved, and that was sort of one of the first things that we discussed as a committee. Said, you know, is this the spot? Are we behind it? And it was 100% yes from that committee. And obviously, there's other ideas, and there's advantages of you know, going further out of town where there's more space. But myself, my view is that, you know, this having it here right in the heart of town is an advantage. Yes. Car parking can be an issue, particularly when there's a big event, and you know, we'll put it out there that everybody has the same complaint. But I think just the vibrancy it adds to Clare as a town, yeah, I think it's a real advantage. And you know, kids walk down from school, you know, come here on a Tuesday night, Thursday night when there's a training down, and there's kids everywhere, you know. And to put it 5 km out of town, just, you know, we lose the ability to be able to do that. Yeah, no, I think this is the space. And on top of that, for us to relocate everything, netball, tennis, basketball, we're back to a $20 million project, which we know we're not going to find. So,
what's been the process like for you? I mean, you, I hear, have been quite instrumental in getting this project over the line. How have you found this? Because this is what you do for a job as well, but it's all been volunteering from your perspective or on your behalf. How have you found it?
Yeah, it's been, I've certainly learnt a lot. Like, I don't do community projects sort of like this. I mean, I've got a background in project management, but typically sort of working in industry, which is a little bit different because, you know, a lot of the time spent on this project has been sort of seeking out funding partners and that sort of stuff, which is typically something I've not done. So yeah, I've learnt a lot. It's taken a lot of time, but it has been quite rewarding as well to be able to sit here and, you know, see the project kick off. That's quite rewarding.
So what has been the major hurdles that you've found over how many years has it been since you've been involved?
2019. Oh, look, there's been plenty. I mean, initially we probably didn't enjoy the full support of all the councillors and everybody on council, but I mean, that fortunately that sort of seems to have turned around in more recent times. But you know, we got the state government grant pretty early on in the piece, so the 2020 we got that funding, and you know, that was sort of contingent on spending it within a certain time frame, and we weren't able to do that. So you know, there was always the threat that we would lose that money, and just trying to keep all the funding partners happy has probably been one of the major hurdles. The BBRF, we'd really needed the BBRF grant to come through, and it did eventually, but it took 6 months longer than they said it would, and it actually came out of the blue a little bit. That announcement was originally meant to be, or touted to be made in around May of 2021, and it didn't get made till the end of October. So, you know, we sort of had 6 months sort of fairly idle there, and then it sort of came. Last thing we'd heard was it probably wouldn't happen till early this year, in and around, you know, to fit in with the election timing. So we weren't really expecting it to come through. And yeah, look, ultimately, if we didn't get that grant, if we weren't successful in that round, we would have had to give back our state funding. We would have been back to the start again anyway. So,
had you tried for a federal grant before?
We did, yeah. We tried in 2020 as well, round four, and we had some pretty good feedback. Like, those grants are assessed on four key areas, and the major ones are economic benefit and social benefit, and we scored really well in those two areas. And then the other areas around, I can't remember how they word it, but it's basically like, how prepared are you to execute this project if you get the grant? And we weren't ready at that stage, and we knew that, but we sort of tried to fumble our way through it anyway. And so it was sort of encouraging that the feedback sort of said that, yeah, the use case and the benefit is there. We had another go in 2021, and by that stage we were a lot further down the road, and you know, we felt we had our project, you know, our project plan was done.
Mm. Had all your ducks in a row.
We did, yeah. And we just needed the money.
Yeah.
And we actually engaged with Hood Sweeney to help us put the grant application together and put a cost benefit analysis together for us. And we ended up with a really strong application, we felt. And you know, we were hearing from the MPs and the local council that, don't hold your breath, it's probably not going to happen. We believed in our application and we thought it was pretty strong. So it was good that it did come through.
How many hours do you think you've put into this project, Ryan?
Oh, I don't know. Lots.
Many years, many hours. My goodness. Yeah. Why did you get involved in it?
I was a secretary for one of the footy clubs. So I was sort of hearing, you know, at the committee meetings, you get the updates from the guys who were on the committee at the time. And I really strongly believe that that we needed the project to go ahead to help ensure the ongoing viability of the clubs. Yeah, and when it sort of stalled, it was pretty frustrating. And so, yeah, I thought, well, I can sulk about it, or I can have a go myself and see what I can do. So,
you've just secured a bridging finance loan from council.
Yes.
Was that a struggle to get? And what does that mean?
It wasn't really at the end of the day. I mean, what it means is the federal government, they pay our grant 6 months in arrears. So, you know, our project runs for just over 12 months. So 6 months into the project, we do a milestone. We say we spent this much money. And then they pay their percentage of the project value, which is 46%. They pay on the amount we've spent 6 months in and probably at 60 days. So we're looking at 8 months to get a cent from that program. So we've modelled our cash flow and worked out, you know, based on when we expect to get those instalments back in. You know, we had some holes. The bridging finance that the council's offered us or secured for us, you know, that'll just enable us to keep going. Yeah, we'll have to borrow the money and pay some interest on that, but it's only short term. We're only talking a few months at a time. So just enables us to keep going unimpeded and know that we can pay our suppliers and, you know, we're not going to have to put them on hold while we're waiting for some cash to come through.
If you couldn't get that finance, what would you have done?
Don't know. There was some possibility that we could talk to the state government about doing some of it. This advice came from the RDA, but ultimately, yeah, the best option was always going to be local government for this. I mean, this type of project would typically be delivered by a local government, not a, you know, not-for-profit community group, and we sort of need that big brother.
You said that it's due to be finished in June next year.
Yes.
like all projects, they never seem to run on time. How difficult do you think it's going to be roll with a project like this, considering all the complications that COVID has brought? Cost of materials are skyrocketing, and then having to fundraise in a climate like this. You've picked the most difficult time to construct such a major project.
Yes. Yes, I've said that several times. There's probably not a worse time in history to be doing this, but hopefully we've seen that pain already, hopefully. So in between receiving the BBRF funding in October last year and now, you know, we've had to go back to this project was budgeted in at the end of 2020 when we put that federal grant application together. So, you know, we basically were running off tenders that were 12 months out of date, and that 12 months was a pretty big 12 months in the construction industry. And so obviously the first thing we started doing when we got the grant announcement in October was like, okay, where were we at with our price? And every element was through the roof, and we came back at around about 700,000 over our original budget. We didn't really know what we were going to do at that stage. We were still going through and looking, okay, where's our opportunities to claw that back and get that number down. We did go to the council for $500,000 loan, and that was sort of to buy us some time. So to execute the federal agreement, we had to be able to demonstrate we had the money to do it, or to do our bit. Yeah, ultimately we just came to the realisation that we're going to have to cut something out because we can't afford to do the whole lot. So we made the difficult decision to pull the oval resurfacing out of the scope. So we're not going to be doing the oval at this time. There is some advantages in doing that. We're going to do this little bit here that's inside the construction zone, and it gives us an opportunity to pilot some different types of turf and just see how they all respond to the, you know, we've got pretty unique conditions here. You know, the cold, frosty winters gives us an opportunity to test some grass types out and make sure when we do the whole oval, you know, we've got some data to help make the right choice on what service we go with there. But also, like, it brought the project back to a manageable level. Like, we were just way too lean, you know, trying to squeeze it all in, just we wouldn't have been successful. So I feel a lot more comfortable with the budget where it is now with that part removed.
So yeah. Once the project is finished, it's all up and running.
Yep.
What about maintaining the building, the grounds? Is that going to be an extra cost now to the Clare Sports Club?
Shouldn't be significantly extra. I mean, we maintain the grounds anyway. We maintain all those different disparate buildings. We maintain this venue here as well. But it's bigger. It'll be a little bit more expensive, but we're confident that, you know, in the business case, that the facility will return the money we need to do that.
Yeah. So with this new facility, what are some additions that we will be seeing that we haven't currently got out there already?
Well, some of the highlights are obviously the four unisex change rooms, which will make it a lot more attractive to get larger sporting events here, for starters. Female sporting events, like female footy, female cricket, which give the netballers somewhere to shower and get dressed as well. So I think just that inclusiveness is probably one of the big factors. It's also one of our drivers is around the safety issues. We got pedestrians in the common area there. We got traffic roaring through there all day. It's a pretty dangerous spot for young kids when there's lots of traffic and, you know, running between the change rooms and the oval and canteen and the oval and that sort of thing. You know, it's a fairly dangerous situation, and we're glad to see the end of that.
With this upgrade, what other events do you want to see happen?
We're also upgrading the lighting of the oval, so that will enable us to do night sports. Essentially, like the lights that we've got here now are, you know, not sufficient for any sort of form of competitive sport. They're okay to train under, barely, but we're sort of going to a, you know, we've done a full lighting design, and yeah, so the ability to be able to host a night event here, whether it be football or anything really under lights, that's a huge advantage to the community in general. There's large opportunities there to do, you know, social competitions through the, you know, various months of the year and that sort of thing. So yeah, just again increases the use case for the precinct down here.
Footy and netball games are going to be happening at Blyth this year, not here at the Clare Oval. Yep. If it's due to be finished in June next year, and with most projects being delayed, never running on time,
yep,
I presume the next season will also not be happening here.
We're hopeful we can do next season here. When we say June, I mean, hopefully by that stage, by the time April comes around next year, the structure will be up, and we'll just be doing the fit out inside. So the idea being, yep, the new facility probably won't be open for use, but we can still use the oval. At the moment, like, because we're a little bit hemmed in here with the creek on the western side, we need the space out here on the oval. So as you can see, we put the construction fence, you know, 20-30 metres onto the oval, and that's why we've had to relocate this footy and netball for this season. So, but hopefully by the time April comes around next year, that fence will be gone and we'll have full use of the oval. But
we should recognise everybody on this committee that has been working on this redevelopment or this development. Yeah. Can we recognise those people?
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of people who have come and gone over the journey as well. But yes, we've got a very dedicated committee, and that's the current committee is Will Gwyn Jones is the chairperson. We've got Rob Callaby, Katie Liebelt, Nick Heath, who's also the president of the South Clare Sports Club, should be said, which is a pretty onerous job in itself. Ian Pearce, I think Ian's been here since the get-go. And he was also the president of North Clare Football Club for 6 years during that time as well. So he's a tremendous volunteer, Ian. And Justin Rigonovich was the original chairperson for the redevelopment committee when it first kicked off, and he did a power of work to get it to where it was in the early days. And he relocated away from Clare, so unfortunately we weren't able to enjoy his services on the committee after that. But you know, Sam McDonald, like SJM, are our principal contractor. He was very generous with his time in the early days, you know, offering advice and did some drawings for us and all that sort of stuff. And you know, we made him go through a competitive tender process with everybody else. He didn't just get handed this job. And they've been terrific supporters, and you know, I'm pleased for them that they were awarded it at the end of the day. And I think also just like to thank GP Architects, who have been with us since 2019 when we re-established the committee. They've done a lot of work, and a lot of it in kind for us as well, and they've been terrific to work with.
I can just imagine the big opening party right now.
Yeah, well, South are hosting the grand final next year, so the dream is that obviously we'll have it in full flight by then, and that'll be a big day for the precinct. So.
A big day for everyone, and a big day for you guys especially. Yeah. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to chat and to go through this massive project that you've been working on for many years, and I bet you're looking forward to the end of it, the back end of it.
Yeah, definitely.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Annabelle.
Ryan Tregilgis, Project Manager of the Clare Oval Redevelopment Committee. To keep up to date with all the latest news about the redevelopment, follow the Clare Sporting Precinct Redevelopment Project on Facebook. You may notice that they're holding a fundraising community dinner on the 21st of May. It's a three-course dinner by Seed, $100 per person. So get your ticket and support the Oval Redevelopment. For all the latest news and information on all things council-related, head to the Clare and Gilbert Valleys Council's website. If there are any issues or events that you would like covered in this podcast, don't hesitate to get in contact. This podcast is proudly brought to you by the Clare and Gilbert Valleys Council.